From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's President's Day. On today's Fresh Air, some serious and comic impressions of the president. First, we talk with the author of a new biography of President Clinton. Writer David Marinus won a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of Clinton's presidential campaign in the Washington Post. Also, political satirist and impressionist Jim Morris gets into character. His impression of Bill Clinton is so convincing he even fooled the vice president. And a magazine cover story called 100 Visionaries Who Could Change Your Life has got our linguist Jeff Nunberg wondering what it means to be a visionary nowadays. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. U.S. Treasury officials are reportedly close to working out the $20 billion aid package for Mexico. The New York Times says the plan includes protections for the U.S. investment in case Mexico cannot repay the money. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
According to U.S. and Mexican officials quoted by the Times, Mexico will agree to several tough conditions as part of the crisis aid deal, including shrinking the country's money supply and giving Washington effective control over Mexican oil revenues. Those conditions are intended to address Wall Street's fears that another economic collapse in Mexico could prevent the country from paying back the loans, which are part of a $50 billion international relief package. Despite the December devaluation, which caused the peso to lose 40% of its value against the dollar, there are some bright spots. The Journal of Commerce reports that direct foreign investment in Mexico jumped nearly 64% last year to a record $8 billion. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
Mexican peasants are crowding into a refugee camp in Chiapas. Reports say there are more than 5,000 in the camp. There's little to eat. Many of the children are suffering from cholera. The camp's water supply is thought to be contaminated. The villagers abandoned their homes earlier this month when army troops began to take on the Zapatista rebels. The Zapatistas launched their rebel offensive more than a year ago, demanding better conditions for poor people in Chiapas. A hearing is scheduled this week in the alleged murder plot against the leader of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan. NPR Cheryl Duvall reports.
Kubla Shabazz, a daughter of the late Malcolm X, pleaded innocent last month to federal charges that she conspired to have Farrakhan killed. Members of the Shabazz family have long maintained that Farrakhan was involved in Malcolm X's murder, though the Nation of Islam leader has denied this. In the weeks since Kubla Shabazz's arraignment, African American leaders across the nation have rallied to her support and have questioned, along with her attorney William Kunstler, the FBI's use of an informant who knew Shabazz in high school. Kunstler has asked the federal government to drop the charges against his client, and Farrakhan has denounced the government's case as a ploy to confuse and divide African Americans. Wednesday's hearing falls a day after the 30th anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination. The case is scheduled to go to trial in May. I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
The last Cuban refugees have been flown out of Panama to the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. U.S. military officials say the final group of 13 left today. They were among some 8,500 who arrived at camps in Panama 6 months ago to relieve crowding at the U.S. Navy base in Cuba. Panama allowed the Cubans to enter its territory, but it said the United States had to pay the cost. The Panamanians also put a 6-month time limit on the refugees' stay. The stock market is closed today in observance of the President's Day holiday. This is NPR. A New York congressman says he wants to make English the country's official language. Republican Peter King says he'll introduce legislation tomorrow. His National Language Act would end all federal programs that promote bilingualism. King says bilingualism was intended to help immigrants adapt to American society, but he says its effect has been the complete opposite. King says bilingualism reduces the need for immigrants to learn English, and in turn, he says, that excludes them from mainstream society. King's bill would require that all election ballots be printed in English. PLO leader Yasser Arafat has called an emergency meeting of PLO leaders in Cairo tomorrow to discuss the stalled peace talks with Israel. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian sources said that Yasser Arafat is frustrated with Israel's refusal to move on to the next stage of the peace process and is considering breaking off the talks. Israel was supposed to withdraw its troops from Palestinian population centers last summer in preparation for Palestinian elections. But a series of extremist attacks, including several suicide bombings, has left dozens of Israelis dead. And Israeli officials say they can't pull out unless the PLO does more to crack down on the extremists. At a meeting last week, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin offered Arafat municipal control of the West Bank town of Jenin without any Israeli pullout. Arafat rejected the offer and said Israel must commit to a timetable for troop withdrawal. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A blasphemy case in Pakistan has brought hundreds of Muslim fundamentalists into the streets of Islamabad. Police in riot gear formed a chain today around a court where a Christian teenager has appealed his death sentence. The 14-year-old boy and his uncle were convicted of writing anti-Islamic slogans on a mosque wall. The mandatory penalty is death. The protesters outside the court shouted threats against the judges and the lawyers. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this President's Day, my guest is the author of a new biography of President Bill Clinton titled First in His Class. Writer David Marinus is a Washington Post reporter who won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Clinton's presidential campaign. Bill and Hillary Rodham Clinton declined to be interviewed for the book, although Marinus had spoken with them while he covered the presidential campaign. Several of the stories Marinus reveals in the biography have made news. One of them is about how Clinton decided against running for president in 1988, shortly after a meeting with his chief of staff, Betsy Wright. She had listed the names of women with whom he had allegedly had affairs and asked him to tell her the truth about each one and to determine who might make trouble for the campaign. After hearing his answer, she advised him not to run.
Well, they met about 2 days before Clinton was about to announce to run for president in 1988. And the context of that meeting was that only a few months earlier, Gary Hart had dropped out of the race, primarily because of problems with infidelity or alleged infidelity on his part. And Betsy Wright was Clinton's longstanding chief of staff. There had been rumors in Washington and around Little Rock about Clinton's own sex life. And the two of them met at Betsy Wright's house to go over a list of women who might be problematic for Clinton. The part that's interesting to me is not so much the women involved as what it said about Clinton and his feeling perhaps of invulnerability even after Gary Hart had gone through a similar episode. There was a sense that Clinton was ready to run up to the last minute, up to that meeting when they went over the list.
Why did Betsy Wright advise him not to run?
Well, she advised him not to run because she thought that he would have trouble. I think it's as simple as that on that issue. I mean, it was a...
Trouble with women coming forward saying yes, they'd had affairs.
Perhaps. And whether there were women who really did or didn't, she wasn't certain about, but she thought it would be troublesome.
Now, she told you, I believe, in an interview for this book, that she had constantly dealt with the issue of Clinton having affairs during the 80s when she worked for him in the governor's office. What did she tell you?
She told me I had several interviews with Betsy Wright. I don't mind talking about this, but I want to point out that it's about four paragraphs in a 500-page book. And it's not what the book is really about, except in a sense of trying to convey one of Clinton's characteristics. In any case, she told me in one of those interviews that over the years she had a feeling that state troopers were helping Clinton get women.
It seems to me you're not real interested in talking about this particular section of Clinton's life or of your book.
No, I'm willing to talk about it. I just don't like to focus on it to the exclusion of all else because I chose purposely in this book not to focus on it too much.
Tell me why. I mean, tell me, like in writing a biography of a president while he's still in office, what is appropriate and what is inappropriate in terms of the man's sexual life and rumors about him sexually? Tell me how you wanted to handle this.
Well, I wanted to study his personality. And he is a man of enormous appetites. I think that sex is one part of his enormous appetite. And I wanted to study that and see where it came from. And I think in the book you get a clear sense of him at an early age of having that appetite. I didn't want to because all these people are still alive, I didn't want to deal with every woman that he'd been involved with over the years, nor did it, that would have taken me a long time probably to track all of them down. And that was not the focus of what I wanted this book to be about. I was trying to write a book about why Clinton, out of all the people of our generation, was the first to become president. And I wanted to write a book that explored the tests of our generation through Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Just one more question on this. Do you think it should matter whether he had affairs or not?
That's for everyone else to decide on their own. I wasn't willing, nor do I want to make that judgment. I think it should matter when those affairs might conflict with his public duties. And I think that in 1987, when he was about to run for president, the fact that he came so close right after Gary Hart had dropped out showed a sense of him thinking that he was invulnerable or that he could cover up anything. And I think that was somewhat dangerous.
You spend a lot of time in your biography of President Clinton on the draft, which you see, I think, as a turning point in his life, a turning point in defining his future. What were some of the internal conflicts you think he was going through when he was trying to figure out what course he should take when he wanted to complete his time at Oxford and he knew that he'd be called to serve?
I think that Vietnam and the draft are a major test of all young men in his generation, my generation, and I spend six chapters writing about, weaving it in and out of six chapters. Clinton faced several contradictions. He came from a part of the country, the South, where most of his high school friends went into the service. Four of his high school friends were killed in Vietnam. He felt a lot of pressure from home to go to Vietnam. When he was at Oxford, he wanted to stay there, obviously. He was with a cohort of other Rhodes Scholars who were against the war. He was against the war and had been since he worked for Senator Fulbright on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in his college days at Georgetown. And also he had the pressure of knowing that he wanted a life in public service, in politics. So any decision he made, he realized, would come back to him later. So he was faced with sort of a three-way pressure that was very difficult for him. And he went through a lot of agony. Some of it might have been hyperbolic in his letters to friends, but I think that he really was struggling to find a way through it. Now, Clinton is a remarkably protean character who's always searching for a way to get through trouble. And in fact, he found a way to make it look like he wanted to serve when in fact he didn't. But that came back to haunt him later.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he signed up for an ROTC program at the University of Arkansas Law School. He really didn't want to go there.
He didn't want to go to the University of Arkansas Law School.
I don't think he wanted to go to the University of Arkansas Law School at all. He would have been happy to go to Yale Law School, which he later did. And he didn't want to be in the ROTC program. But on the other hand, he had been drafted, and if he had not signed up for that, he would have been inducted into the military. He was about to face an induction on July 28th, 1969, when he made the deal with the ROTC at Arkansas to go there. Now, after he made the deal, he cut a separate deal with the colonel who ran the ROTC program to let him go back to Oxford for a while. And as soon as he went back to Oxford, the Nixon administration changed its policy on Vietnam, made it possible for graduate students to serve out a whole year in school, even if they were drafted. And the Vietnamization process was starting. They stopped inducting troops in the first three months that Clinton was back. And they were about to go to a lottery system. So everything made it clear to Clinton and to his friends that they would be safe for a while. And at that point, he withdrew his deferment and took his chances on the lottery and got a lucky number. So he got out of everything.
So you say that the essential question in this part of his life is not so much what he did as why he did it. Was he driven by guilt and honor, or was this a draft-wise young man playing every angle?
That's what I say in the book, and I also say that it looked like he was playing every angle, but there was an honest agony involved in it, too. I'm not harshly down on one side. I'm a little more harsh about how he handled it later when it is clear that he was deceptive about what happened to him. As he was about to run for president in 1992, actually in late 91, in an interview with a colleague of mine at the Washington Post, he said that he did not get drafted when he was at Oxford. And in fact, there are documents and letters in my book which show it was clear that he did receive the draft notice.
So what's the significance of this chapter in Bill Clinton's life in your reading of Bill Clinton as a man?
Well, I think it shows, it's one more example that shows the internal conflict between ambition and idealism that was always there with Bill Clinton and the Faustian bargains that he had to make along the way. He was a man who always wanted to be president. And so every decision he made had to be weighed in that balance. And sometimes it affected him adversely. I think that the main reason Clinton was different from the millions of other young men who did similar things to avoid the draft in one way or another during that era is that he had to deal with it for the rest of his life, where there, so many other people could forget about it. But because he wanted to go into public service, the manipulation that he went through haunted him.
And just to put this into more context, what about his friends who were at Oxford with him?
Yeah, I think that's an important context. There were 31 of the 32 Rhodes Scholars that year went to Oxford. The 32nd, a man named Jack Pratt, felt guilty about the fact that his draft board was about to give him a deferment. So he enlisted in the military right away. He didn't want to have any special privileges. Now, of the other 31, two were actually in the military from the military academy, so they don't count in that sense. Of the others, more than half of them got deferments that year, that first year at Oxford, after the federal government had eliminated graduate school deferments. They got those deferments just off the blessing of their local draft boards, who were so proud to have them as Rhodes Scholars. And so in that sense, Bill Clinton's special treatment, quote-unquote, was indeed special compared to working-class kids around the country who had absolutely no choice. It was not special in comparison to the other Rhodes Scholars. Many of those Rhodes Scholars got off for various so-called ailments, bum knees, like Strobe Talbot, now the Deputy Secretary of State, had a bum knee from his prep school days, but he could still play squash. Others had migraine headaches or whatever and still were great tennis players and swimmers. Everybody got out in one way or another who wanted to.
I think one theme that runs through your biography of Bill Clinton is that there seem to be two different sides to his personality. What are those two sides?
One side is manipulative and deceptive and fueled by a desire to make it, deep ambition. There's a scene where his first campaign in Arkansas, he's working for a judge named Judge Hold, who was running for governor, and David Pryor, then a young congressman, bumped into Bill Clinton for the first time. And after their meeting, he turned to his wife and said, "He's on fire. That boy's on fire." In that, Bill Clinton would do just about, well, not anything, but did a shade the truth, do several questionable things to get where he wanted to go. The other Bill Clinton is tireless, empathetic, optimistic, and a great friend to people. And it's the classic battle between darkness and light. Clinton even talks about it in one part of the book. After he was defeated in 1980, he went up to the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville to talk to a political science class, and he talked about how in most leaders there is that constant struggle between darkness and light. And in Clinton's case, I'm not willing to say that either side has prevailed. It's still going on.
Journalist David Marinus is my guest. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. David Marinus is my guest. He's the author of a new biography of Bill Clinton called First in His Class. What's your assessment of him as president so far?
Well, I say that my book ends the day he announced for president, but everything that's happened since is in the book. I think that there are recurring themes in his life that are evident in him as president. He achieves things, but he's also confounding. I think that I wouldn't count him out yet, but he's had, the troubles he's had do not surprise me. I think that in terms of his attempts to appease all sides, starting with the gays in the military issue, which reminded me so much of a lot of incidents in his past, where he was looking for a middle ground, couldn't find it, and in essence, both sides came out mad at him.
Can you give us an example of one of those instances?
From his past?
Yeah.
Sure. In his first term again as governor, he wanted to rebuild the road system there. It was pretty bad shape because there were roads where school buses couldn't even get to the schools in rural Arkansas. So he decided to advance a major roads program. And it would be taxed largely on the backs of the major trucking interests in the state and the poultry interests, who were the major truckers. Now, poultry is very powerful in Arkansas. They formed a coalition against him. The highway lobby, on the other hand, loved his program at first. Clinton at first supported the highway lobby, then he changed his mind and supported the trucking lobby's proposal, and both sides thought that he was double-crossing them. They both got mad at him. It turned into a disaster, and both sides eventually worked to defeat Clinton.
Your biography is of a current president, and I think it must be very hard to write a biography of a man who's in the White House. I think when somebody leaves, then the president himself and others around him become more circumspect, a little more willing to talk. But while he's in, particularly if he's considering a second term, it's, I'm sure, quite difficult to get people to really level with you. So tell us a little bit about what you were up against in trying to write this book.
I think you're right. It's very rare for a biography of this sort to be written while someone's president. I'm not sure it's been attempted to this degree before. And I knew it would be difficult. I had covered Clinton during the campaign, so I knew scores, if not hundreds, of people whose lives had intersected with his over his life, and many of them trusted me. Clinton and Hillary were sort of on record as saying that I was a fair reporter, but as soon as I started a biography, Clinton in particular was not happy about it because he is a political animal and he would be running for re-election, and he understood the calculation of having a book about his past coming out while he was in office would be a touchy one. So he did not cooperate. On the other hand, he did not tell his friends not to talk to me, and I talked to hundreds of his friends, 400 people in all. The only instance of uncooperation I got in that sense was three or four of the people connected to Hillary Rodham Clinton called the White House and were told not to talk to me. Other than that, I think that I did about as well as someone could do in those situations. I got a lot of his letters from his past, from past girlfriends and from relatives back in Arkansas. They were very important to me. Documents were important to me wherever I could get them, because, of course, people's memories are always questionable. And I'm sure that it's a funny thing about Clinton that even his closest friends, while they want to present the best side of him, they see the complications in him as well. And so many of them were willing to talk to me about that at all levels of his life.
What do you think of a biography of a president in office should be?
Well, I wanted it to be a fair biography that would explain to people why Clinton is doing what he's doing today so that they might understand him better. That was my larger purpose in that sense.
Is there territory you intentionally stayed away from?
I didn't intentionally stay away from any territory. There were two parts of the book that I spent less time on for practical reasons, or one for practical reasons and one for probably my own philosophy, which we've talked about a little bit. For practical reasons, I didn't make it a Whitewater book. You could write a whole book about Whitewater, and someone is doing it. And that was not what I wanted this book to be. So I wanted to explain Clinton in a way that when the Whitewater stuff happens, however it does, people have an understanding of the man. The other section that I was cautious about was sex, because it's just something that I'm personally not that interested in, except as it relates to his political decisions.
You know, I guess I'm interested in hearing how Bill Clinton appeared differently to you when you were writing about him as a candidate than he does now that you've had this chance to write a 500-page biography of him.
Well, it has more to do with the process of covering a campaign than it does with Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, there's so much pressure during a campaign to come up with something new or just to keep writing stories, every day or whatever, and to compare him with the other candidates and so on. And for instance, all of the stories about Clinton in the draft that were written during the campaign, I would not denigrate any of them. I think they were important and revealing, but none of them really put him into the context of that time. And that's what I wanted so badly to do in this book, and that's why I spent so much time on it. I mean, I am 3 years younger than Bill Clinton. I'm part of that generation. I know how important Vietnam and the draft were to all of us, and I know how many of my friends and everyone's friends did various things, from going to Vietnam, serving there, getting killed, getting out, for all of these reasons. It was a very difficult, complicated time, and it infuriated me that it could be so stereotyped and reduced into one dimension during a campaign. And so that's what I tried to get past in the book.
You know, it's interesting, most of the Republicans at last night's New Hampshire fundraising dinner, people who have thrown their hats into the ring, they're the older generation again.
Some of them are, yeah. Phil Graham got 5 deferments from the draft. That'll be a question. I think that Bill Weld, who is Clinton's generation, and in fact attended the same college at Oxford as Bill 2 years earlier, University College, dealt with the draft in a way that he might not want to have come back to haunt him either. But you're right, Bob Dole is, if he's elected, would be, what, the oldest president in American history before his term was out, older than Reagan. So there is a sense, I think, if I know what you're getting at here, that Clinton was the first baby boom president, but maybe the baby boomers weren't ready for one of their own.
The press has mostly picked up on stories relating to Clinton's sex life. I'm wondering if you think that there are any stories in the book that you feel are most revealing about the president.
I hope that every chapter of the book is revealing. I think that there are recurrent themes in Clinton's life that on a larger scale, I think, are the most important. You can see it in almost any part of his life. I mean, I like the story of when he was at Georgetown, and his first 2 years there, he was elected president of the freshman and sophomore classes. This kid sort of coming out of nowhere in Arkansas and glad handing his way to the presidency both years. And then in his junior year, he decided to run for student council president which would be in his senior year. And his peers got sick of him. They thought he was too closely tied to the Jesuit administration at Georgetown. There was a nascent rebellious mood among the students there that Clinton totally failed to pick up on. He thought he could just handshake and work harder and get elected. And the fellow who defeated him, I sort of compare in a sense to Newt Gingrich, in that he had tapped into sort of a public sentiment, which was rebellious, but this guy, Terry Modlin, who was the other candidate, was kind of more to the right of Clinton, as Gingrich is in a sense. So I just saw that as such a remarkable parallel to things that happened later in Clinton's life. And there are a lot of stories like that in the book that I think sort of resonate.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
David Marinus wrote the new biography of Bill Clinton called First in His Class. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, impersonating the president. Political satirist and impressionist Jim Morris once called up Vice President Gore pretending to be the president and actually fooled him. Morris will do his impressions of the president and some of his rivals. And what do we expect from our so-called visionaries? Do they ever get the future right? Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Several Republican candidates for president have been making stops in New Hampshire today, wrapping up a three-day weekend in the state, which kicks off the primary season next year. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports that most of the GOP candidates say changing affirmative action will be one of their top priorities in the upcoming campaign.
The first presidential primary is a year away, but already affirmative action appears to be a major issue for Republicans. Speaking on CBS this weekend, Texas Senator Phil Graham said one of his first actions as president would be to overturn what he called quotas, preferences, and set-asides. On ABC, two other GOP contenders also spoke out against current affirmative action programs, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole and former Tennessee Governor Lamar Alexander.
I think equal opportunity in this country does not mean treating people as groups, it means treating them as individuals. And as president, I would try to translate equal opportunity into individual rights, not group rights.
Meanwhile, the new chairman of the NAACP, Merle Evers Williams, said the civil rights group will be very vocal about any attempts to roll back what she called the gains made over the years. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
An Algerian newspaper says an extremist Muslim faction has claimed responsibility for a series of attacks earlier this month. The newspaper reports the armed Islamic group, the GIA, says it attacked a police post across the border in Tunisia. The group also says it was behind the killing of several prominent civilians last week. The BBC's Alfred Hermida reports.
The past week in Algeria was marked by a series of assassinations of well-known figures in the arts, education, and politics. The victims included the director of the National Theatre, a student leader, and a prominent feminist. The Algerian daily La Tribune quoted the armed Islamic group, the GIA, as saying it killed the civilians because they were communists and the enemies of Islam. The newspaper also reported that the GIA said it carried out a raid into Tunisia earlier this month. The group said its militants had crossed the border and attacked a guard post, killing several Tunisian policemen. La Tribune said the attack was a warning to the Tunisian government against suppressing its own Islamic movement. The Tunisian authorities have not confirmed that the raid took place. If it did, it would be the first time Algerian militants have attacked a neighboring country.
Alfred Hermida reporting. Security sources are reporting Israeli warplanes have attacked guerrilla targets in southern Lebanon at least twice today. The region is said to be used repeatedly by Arab guerrillas who are trying to infiltrate Israel. The air raids came just a few hours after the guerrillas attacked a hilltop outpost of an Israeli-backed militia. The security sources say the militia and Israeli forces struck back with artillery and tank fire. Arab guerrillas then launched simultaneous attacks on a dozen Israeli and militia outposts. This is NPR News from Washington. In Moscow today, the activities of American financier George Soros were the subject of a parliamentary hearing. NPR's Anne Gerrels has more.
Hungarian-born George Soros has given away so much money in the former Soviet bloc, he's been called a one-man foreign aid agency. Among his many projects to support post-communist development, Soros and his International Science Foundation have provided $100 million to fund basic scientific studies. But according to newspaper reports here, the Federal Counterintelligence Service, the successor to the KGB, believes Soros, with more than goodwill in mind, has used his foundation to spy. The head of the Soros Foundation here denies this, stressing Soros does not support applied science or projects related to defense. Other speakers told Parliament the Russian Ministry of Science needs more than twice the funding the government can provide and that Soros has helped bridge the gap. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
President Clinton is criticizing what he calls the extreme right wing of the Republican Party for its opposition to Surgeon General nominee Dr. Henry Foster. Mr. Clinton charged today on CBS that the right wing believes all abortions should be criminalized and anyone who's ever performed one should be disqualified from holding high office. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole is accusing President Clinton of trying to divide the Republicans over the Foster nomination by turning the debate into one on abortion. Dole says if there aren't enough votes to confirm Foster, his nomination should be withdrawn. A published report says a cost-cutting plan for NASA could mean big changes in the space shuttle program. The Houston Post says the plan calls for shifting management of the shuttle program from Johnson Space Center in Houston to Cape Canaveral, Florida. The plan says Houston would lose other engineering work, but it would take on space station science operations and the satellite network used to communicate with orbiting spaceships. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Clinton was too busy to join us on this President's Day, but we do have political impressionist Jim Morris. He's done his impressions of Bill Clinton at comedy clubs, on CNN's Crossfire, The Tonight Show, and the White House. President Clinton is just one of many political figures that Morris has down. I asked Jim Morris if President's Day is a busy day for him.
It's one of reflection. I mean, I feel like it's my holiday because I've played so many presidents.
That's right.
I was a president in high school. I was my class president for 2 years, my junior and senior. And I was reelected because I ran a good, clean administration.
So you were a president before you started impersonating them?
Yeah, I must have had this thing for presidents. And now I expect the same of our elected officials as I expected of my own administration. No diverting funds to the school bullies or anything like that.
Really? Well, let me ask you to get into character as President Clinton for a bit. How has life changed for you with a Republican Congress?
Well, the good news is now we have, there's a contrast. You can look and see just how more compassionate I feel that we are and what we want to do. For instance, the new Speaker of the House and his contract with America. By the way, I think I should say that I'm glad that he cares more about his contract with America now than his contract with Australia. That book deal is, I know he's getting a lot of money, but he's Speaker of the House. What house? Publishers Clearing House. But seriously, let me just tell you that I feel your pain. When you have to choose between guns or butter, you look and see he doesn't have compassion for the homeless. I do. We have a new program that I'm submitting to Congress. It's called Bring a Bum to Brunch Day. And this is not another one of those budget busters. It's a partnership between the private sector and government. This will not cost a lot of money. You see, you people in the private sector will bring a bum of your choice to brunch, and the government picks up the tip in the form of a tax credit. And I think this will go a long way to solving the problems.
Do you think Newt Gingrich is an effective Speaker of the House? Is he rallying support to his contract?
Well, he sure blows a lot of hot air as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you know, a lot of ethics questions, a lot of misstatements and all this stuff about, I mean, what he said about my wife. Can you believe it? Well, at least there's one thing we both agree on. Just kidding.
Mr. President, a lot of people say that presidents in America today end up being removed from the rest of society and therefore don't really understand what's happening. But you've had an experience that a lot of Americans have been sharing, and that is people shooting at your house. What has it been like to have snipers shooting at the White House?
Well, it's a very humbling experience, I'll tell you that. It is very difficult to comprehend why anybody would want to do something like that. And that's why I'm glad that we signed that crime bill. 30 years ago, we had 3 policemen for every crime committed in this great country of ours. And today, there are 3 crimes for every policeman. Just a few years ago, in Surf City, USA alone, there were 2 girls for every boy. And today, it takes 5 bowls of regular cereal just to equal the vitamins and minerals in 1 bowl of total. I say we can do better.
Have you read the new biography of you?
No, I haven't. I'm waiting for the movie to come out, actually.
Who's going to play you in the movie?
Who's going to play me?
I hear there's some comedian up there making fun of me all the time. He just has to eat a bit more. Actually, I've been doing pretty good in my diet. My doctor tells me to eat well, which I do, get plenty of exercise, which I do, and try to avoid any kind of a draft, which so far I haven't had a problem with, you see, because my voice is always cracking.
Jim Morris, back to you. How has doing Bill Clinton changed for you in the time that Clinton has become president?
Well, as with any impression of a politician or a national figure, it takes the audience time to register and identify with the character. I could be the first on the block to have the impression down pat, and people, if they don't get the references, if they don't understand that you know, it's a good impression, then I'm too far ahead of the audience. So basically, early on, you know, you dealt with sound bites that were recognizable, and now the character's quite a bit more fleshed out because we have a lot more information about his private life and the stands he's taken on various issues, and he's part of the fabric now of our national life.
Do you see him differently than you did when he first became president?
No, not really, because I think that I'm very perceptive about characters, and I work from the inside out, so I really try to feel and think the way the character thinks. So I do my homework before I even get the impression together. So the basic character of the man was established when he was 12 years old. I mean, basically, it hasn't changed, but there's been a lot more twisting in the wind and a lot more material available since he's been in office, and that gives me a lot to work with.
So what do you consider to be the keys to his character that you can work with as an impressionist?
Sort of concern and you know, whether it's mock or not, but I care. I care, my fellow Americans, and I want to do the job that we think we should do in the next century. You know, really, like, he's a great speaker. He's a great politician. He's very smart, and I like that. He's very attractive, and that gives me a lot to work with, and it becomes a polarizing effect for an audience. And it's tougher when you're doing other politicians that people either don't know as well or that are blander. For instance, Lamar Alexander, I don't know what I would pick up on yet. On the other hand, Phil Graham is real easy already.
I want a tax cut that we're not going to end up paying for with higher interest rate.
You know, he's very exaggerated already.
Let me ask Phil Graham a question.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Graham was at that Republican fundraiser last night in New Hampshire, the kind of really early kickoff of the campaign. And he said, unlike the current president, I know who I am. So my question is, Phil Graham, who are you?
I was a nerd before being a nerd was cool.
He said he was a conservative before being a conservative was cool. Actually, between you and me, I just start with phrases and sentences, and then I work to paragraphs, and so at this point, that work in progress is limited to just a few sound bites.
One of the Republicans in the race is Bob Dole. Now, he's been at the forefront of Republican politics for a long time, so I imagine you have him down already.
Yeah. Well, Bob Dole is sort of repackaging. He wants us to see him as a nice guy, an everyman's kind of guy, and I just wrote this piece of material for him.
Well, I can't play the saxophone, but just to show I get a sense of humor about myself, I think I'll bare my butt on NYPD Blue.
Well, talk to me about Bob Dole, about getting his voice and what you pick up on in his personality.
Oh, I can't really describe it. It's one of these things that I just do in his case. Sort of a wry sense of humor, very droll. I can't describe it. I just do it. And there's another work in progress that if he were to become the party's nominee, that I would launch full-fledged into
the campaign as I would become Bob Dole for a half hour at a time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Morris. He's a satirist and political impressionist. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with political impressionist Jim Morris. Now, where are you in perfecting your Newt Gingrich?
I'm a couple weeks away, and until I'm ready, it's really hard for me to do it, because what happens is you know, when I go on television or even radio and do an impression that I will end up doing for a few years, anytime they rerun the program or somebody tapes it and looks at it again, I just can't live with a second-rate job, so I'm waiting until it's ready.
I mean, you have to do Newt Gingrich for you to have a political life right now, right?
Yes, I have bills to pay.
So how are you going about learning Gingrich?
Well, I watch tapes. I watch him on C-SPAN, which is...
there's plenty of opportunities to watch him.
Yeah, he's really out there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the sound... The comedy comes from his sound bites... get taken out of context, or maybe not, and the meat of it really is listening to him for like an hour, and he can talk that long, no problem. And I like him in the sense that he's very smart, very knowledgeable, knows history. I find myself lately reading up on a lot of history so that I can sort of challenge him in my own mind. No, Jefferson did not mean that when he said that about tyranny and God and all that. You know, so he's a challenge because he's very smart, and I don't agree with him on most things, but you listen to him for a half hour at a time and you say, well, you know, he does have some very good ideas, and he is a formidable presence, and things have changed with him in Washington.
Now, when you're working on your Newt Gingrich impression, are you picking up mostly on his voice, on his mannerisms, something else?
The voice is crucial, but body language also. And I find with him, I'm at the point now where I've got to get the voice because I already know his mindset, and also have to, you know, write a lot of material for him. But the material will be easy compared to getting the voice. Before the voice comes, the attitude has to be there, the essence of the guy. And I'm real close on that, and then I figure the voice will follow suit.
Is there anything really pronounced about the voice that you can pick up on, or is it harder to grasp than, say, Bill Clinton, who has that raspiness Southern accent?
Bill Clinton was very difficult. Most of them are very difficult at first.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rare gift when someone like a Paul Tsongas comes by, you know, economic truth. I live in the private sector, and now I'm working with the Concord Coalition and Phil Graham. But usually they're very difficult. Bill Clinton was very difficult. I remember Reagan was very difficult. Bush wasn't as difficult for me.
But Ronald Reagan, of course, you know, I was asked what I thought about Newt Gingrich. And I think he's a fine fellow. He said that he stands on my shoulders. No wonder I have a bad back.
I know you performed at the White House a few months ago, and I believe that the president and vice president were there and saw you?
Well, yes. It was a sort of an impromptu thing. I was meeting with the vice president, and...
You were meeting with him?
Well, sure. I surprised him. They were throwing a surprise birthday party for him. And I called up as President Clinton on speakerphone and totally fooled him until I said, hey, one more thing, Al. And he said, yes, Bill. Keep your grubby little hands off my desk while I'm in California. And there was this silence, and then everybody started laughing. They had cabinet members in there in the Roosevelt room and everything. So it went over really well, and they told me, hey, the vice president would love to meet you.
next time you were in Washington. And so I was meeting with him, and he brought me into the Oval Office, and it was just the three of us in there for a while, and I was goofing on both of them. It was hilarious.
Say it looks the same as when I let same pictures in the same carpet, same. There's that stain we could never get out from Billy Carter over there,
and it was just hilarious. And then some people came in for a national security meeting, and I went into my Clinton impression. I said, "Come on, y'all know where to sit. Let's go." It was just a great experience.
So, is this the first time you got to do Clinton and Gore with them being present?
Yes. Yes.
Is that always a nerve-wracking experience for you because you don't know if they'll think it's
funny? For me, it's like playing in the... Oh, for me, it's the World Series. It's making it to the World Series. When you can do an impression of someone to their face and they happen to be the leader of the free world...
Right.
and survive to tell about it. Because I think that if I lived in another century, another country, another culture, this just wouldn't be permitted. And I can do for a living what I used to get sent to the principal's office for as a kid. I think it's great.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for having me.
Jim Morris is a political satirist and impressionist. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. David Malpas has a report tonight on the political dissatisfactions of middle-class white men in this country who feel oppressed by the fact that, in their view, the government seems to be offering preferential treatment to other groups. Anthony Brooks reports from Vermont on a welfare reform movement underway there, new money for job training and placement. Dan Collison has the story of a bail bondsman at work. Mary Kay Magstad on the trade difficulties between China and the U.S., and I will talk with the translator of a book published in France in 1969 and now in the U.S., a complete book written without the letter E. For example, the Shakespeare line, to be or not to be, becomes living or not living.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. They say that one reason why George Bush lost the presidential election is that he couldn't cope with what he called the vision thing. In the 90s, we expect our political and business leaders to be visionaries. As our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, it's a curious shift for a word that used to only apply to saints, poets, and madmen.
The cover story in the Utney Reader this month is called 100 Visionaries Who Could Change Your Life. Apparently, the idea is to make this a yearly feature, the Utney 100. That's an awful lot of vision, and they've had to stretch things a bit. Most of the names are predictable. There are the oracles from organizations like the Institute for the Future and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and the CEOs of companies like Thinking Machines and Voyager Software. But I'm not sure about some of the other people they've got there. I love the director John Waters, but you wouldn't call him a visionary. I mean, you look at Divine in Pink Flamingos, she's not really a vision, is she? More like a sight. Still, the editors meant it as a compliment. It's a bull market for visionaries these days. It's curious, all these politicians and CEOs lining up to claim a label that people used to reserve for people like St. Teresa or Keats or Coleridge. You wonder what William Blake would have made of all those companies that ask every employee to provide an annual list of their visions and missions. I suppose it's just one more sign of the religiosity that's never far from the surface in American political and corporate life. But of course, when the CEOs and politicians on the Utney 100 talk about their visions, you're not supposed to think of either Kublai Khan or Mickey in the Night Kitchen. These are worldly folks, and when they're not dealing with the here and now, they're pondering the here and someday. You would have thought we already had enough words for a person who predicts the future: soothsayer, fortune teller, sibyl, seer, oracle, prophet. But the new visionaries have staked out a terrain of their own. For one thing, they take the long view of things. A forecaster is somebody who predicts that the 49ers will win the Super Bowl again next year. A visionary is somebody who predicts that the Tampa Bay Bucks will win it by the year 2050. This may be due to a difference in imagination or gaze, but I expect it also has something to do with a mode of payment. The forecasters don't collect their rewards unless they get the future right, so they can't look ahead too many quarters. Whereas the visionaries are only required to make the future sound interesting. If they can look decades down the pike, it's because they get to pick up their checks before the coffee carts have even been rolled away. That's what a visionary is, really, just a prophet with an honorarium. In fact, in the end, we really don't care much whether visionaries are getting the future right. 25 years ago in Future Shock, Alvin Toffler was predicting that marriage contracts would soon become temporary, that paper clothes would soon replace cloth, that airports, hotels, and shopping centers would soon cease to look alike. A few years later in Megatrends, John Nesbitt was saying that California would keep on growing, that the Chrysler bailout was bound to fail, that cable TV would beat out the networks, but that home shopping would be a washout. But people keep buying these guys' books because they offer edification, wonder, even a promise of salvation. Like Blake or Joseph Smith, they have seen the New Jerusalem, but its portals are only going to open to those who welcome their high-tech redemption. That's the one thing all visionaries are obliged to do, is paint the world to come as a better place. We talk about prophets of doom, but there are no contrarian visionaries. They're the priests in the temple of progress. I suppose that's what makes it so hard to think of somebody like John Waters in this company. You don't think of a visionary as somebody with a sense of irony, much less a pencil mustache. Newt Gingrich didn't make the Utney 100 list, but then the magazine probably went to bed before the election. Gingrich has a foundation of his own dedicated to creating a positive vision of the future, as they say, and you can be sure he won't make the same mistake that George Bush did, of fumbling the vision thing. In fact, the whole contract with America has an almost apocalyptic tone to it in the best chiliastic tradition of American politics. They ride to the mountaintop at twilight, and they look down over the desert, and they say, someday there'll be a balanced budget here. Then their term limit comes up, and they slip off into the sunset, leaving the rest of us wondering what's gone down. Just like Keats, after the nightingale stopped singing. Was it a vision or a waking dream?
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.